pretty well. Now, publicly, some of you would feel obligated to say never. Your reverence for God, or at least your particular religious enculturation, might not allow you to admit to such a thing. We certainly don't do that collectively in worship. We give thanks, we confess, we do not have a public fussing time in worship, usually, when we are in God's presence. No, we fuss at God in secret. Maybe not often. And when we do, it's probably about our most intense and private disappointments, questions, fears. We argue with God by ourselves. And if your God can't take you kicking up your heels now and then, if your God can't take you being honest to the very core of your spiritual self, well, then that's really not much of a God now, is it? Someone, though, still needs biblical confirmation of this. After all, they just can't imagine getting upset with God and then expressing that, or at least having permission to. This is in that category of things that some people don't want to take my word for. So let me remind you to go read the Psalms. We have an entire category out of the Psalms that's called the Psalms of Lament. Go read Habakkuk. Go read Job, just for starters. Get back to me on what you found. Jesus got fussed at a little by no less than two people in John chapter 11. And to make matters worse, it might have been the very people he least wanted to disappoint. These were the people who were upset with him at the moment, knowing only what they knew at the time, understanding only what they had the capacity and the experience, the insight and perspective to know at the time. It's perfectly natural that they were upset. Now, I mentioned to you recently that Jesus may have been most uniquely at home in Bethany with Mary and Martha and Lazarus when he was staying at their house. These were some of his very best friends. We've all got that one laid-back friend, though, don't we? The friend who takes laid-back to a whole different level, won't get excited, won't get in a hurry no matter what. My dad used to be manager of a large horse ranch just outside Atlanta. He had a ranch hand named Steve. Steve was a big, powerfully built guy. If you needed some hard work done, Steve was your guy. If you needed something heavy lifted, Steve was your guy. If you needed hurry, if you needed quick, not so much. One day, my dad was driving a big ranch truck that you couldn't see out of very well, and he needed to make a left turn into traffic, no traffic light. He still laughs about the time he asked Steve to look out the right-hand window for him just to make sure it was clear for him to make that turn. He was looking out the left, Steve, will you look out the right? Tell me if it's okay to go. And Steve looked and he said, all right, you're clear. So my dad pulled out and Steve continued, after this one. Now, no one hit, but it made for a story that we still get my dad to tell over and over again. And in the face of the news about Lazarus' health, it could appear that Jesus was taken laid back to a whole nother level. Jesus was off away for a few days. He had just had a hit squad threaten to stone him at Jerusalem for saying that he and God the Father were one. That pronouncement, despite all the miraculous works and signs he had just performed, did not sit well with them. They made it clear why they wanted to stone Jesus. He and the disciples had moved on to another safer area for a little while. Actually, they crossed over the Jericho to where John had been preaching and baptizing, you remember earlier in the Gospels, where he washed the Christ himself in that place. And it was while he was there that word reached Jesus that Lazarus was gravely ill unto death. Inexplicably, Jesus simply stayed where he was. We can't read this and pretend that we don't know how the story is going to work out, because we do. But the action, if we just let ourselves walk through this part of John 11, is compelling on a human level. Even more, what John will do as he tells this story, and stories like this theologically, make sure that we get the idea that our lives never had to be the same after this. On the first Sunday in November, we're going to revisit this story. No one Sunday will hold this story. So we're going to pick up right about where we leave off, and on the first Sunday in November, we're going to come back and revisit this story. But Jesus here is inexplicably laid back about this, and they just couldn't figure why. Why he didn't rush back, just didn't calculate. Of course, Bethany, where they lived, was just a couple of miles or so from where Jesus' life and presumably his disciples with him had just been threatened. I have a very young friend, just barely out of college, who has risen to national prominence of late. This young man is only 25 years old, but almost any TV show or news outlet that you could think of has interviewed him in the last year. I may have mentioned him to you. I know I have in Sunday school. He's about to go on tour with Bernice King and make appearances in churches all over the country. He's an ordained minister and preaches all over the place. And he also lives under the constant specter of death threats from hate groups. We had lunch a few months ago when I was up in Washington, D.C., and only a week or so before I met him for lunch up there, I got an email from him apologizing that he would be bringing someone extra with him in light of the danger upon his life. And while we were together, he told me of one event at which he had just spoken. A couple of weeks before he had gone to speak in that place, the organizers had contacted him to ask him what blood type he was, because one of the death threats against him had been federally validated. And so their security protocols dictated they needed to bank up his blood type. 25 years old. And this has changed the lives of everyone around this young man. It has changed how he travels. His wife waits at home when he's on the road, hoping he'll return. As I rode with him, sat and ate with him in a restaurant, I found myself looking around us to see who was around and what they were doing, paying attention to what was going on in a way I wasn't used to. If you haven't ever been threatened, then it's tough for you and me to fully relate to what's going on here. Jesus had to remember that he was responsible for his entire party of disciples, not just himself, until his time had fully come. He even had a lot of people come to him while he was out there near the Jericho for those few days. They pronounced deep faith in him, affirming that every word John had said about Jesus had turned out to be true. He had work to do out there. And one day Jesus said to his disciples, "Okay, let's go back to Judea." And the disciples reminded him, "Lord, they just tried to stone you there." Jesus responded with some wisdom about walking in the light rather than the dark. It's all there in John chapter 11 for you. And the disciple says, "Yes, but if Lazarus really has just fallen asleep, then he'll wake up and be fine." Even Jesus' closest followers didn't understand what was happening. And so Jesus finally just shot straight with him and said, "Guys, Lazarus is dead." And Thomas, the one we like to call the doubter, lived up to his name in this episode by being the one who finally spoke up and said, "Well, come on, guys. The least we can do is go back and die with him." And did you notice that Jesus, in our reading just a few minutes ago, they headed back, and did you notice that Jesus didn't even make it back into town? Martha went to meet him outside Bethany before the entourage could even arrive. I wonder what her tone was. Sometimes at home I'll say to our cats, "Don't make her put her hand on her hip and point at you," talking about Elizabeth having to get stern with them sometimes. Somehow I picture Martha with her hand on her hip and her finger pointing at Jesus. She could do that. She had that kind of relationship with Him. Even Mary, plenty laid back herself, as you'll see in other gospel stories, repeated the tirade as Jesus finally did get to their house. "Lord, if You'd been here, our brother would not have died." Famously, we're going to see Jesus, a few verses after what we read today, we're going to see Jesus cry in this story. Shortest verse in all the Bible. We all memorized it in my youth group because we could get credit for a memory verse. The shortest verse in the Bible, John 11:35, two words, Jesus wept. And super Christians have tried to soft pedal that one, and we're going to work with that part of the story a few months from now. They try to say that Jesus wasn't really sad, that we shouldn't be sad at death either. I say hogwash. They try to say that His crying there was more just for show, or maybe out of frustration with all the disbelief. I think they're wrong, and we're going to hold on to that thought for a few weeks. For us today, though, something powerful was about to happen. Because a voice was heard that day in our story in a way that no one had heard it before. Something even bigger than the death of a loved one and His resurrection was coming. Because together with Martha in particular, Jesus was about to utter one of the first public affirmations of Him as the promised one. "Lord, I know He'll rise again one day in the resurrection." "Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in Me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in Me will never die. Do you believe this?" And she said to Him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that You are the Messiah, the Son of God, the One coming into the world." And there it was. It sounds so familiar to our ears, it doesn't sound like a big deal. We've been hearing it all our lives, many of us, so comfortably that we don't really hear it. But it's right there. Martha and Jesus' response to her built a bridge. In 1960, a total of 2,000 workers began to line up and interview and accept jobs for the massive project now known as the Lucius J. Kellum Jr. Bridge Tunnel. But we know it locally more as the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. One who was 17 years old then and took one of those jobs hired on for the grand total of $1.83 an hour. The total cost for the bridge was an estimated $200 million. They would work for 3.5 years and span a total of 17.6 miles from shore to shore, as you know. And 7 men would die in those 3.5 years in that construction effort. A Virginia Pilot piece done in 2014 commemorated the bridge's 50th anniversary. It remains one of the longest spans in the world, and it's right here under our noses. Audrey West, in her comments on John 11, right here where our story comes from, says that with their voices, Jesus and Martha spoke quite a significant bridge into being. And it all happened so fast in language that's become so familiar to us that we don't notice it. A narrative bridge that connected Jesus' public ministry with the events that were about to happen, the final Passover and His death and resurrection. They created a bridge right here in this story that brought it all together for us in a necessary, powerful, beautiful way. Here's where it all met up. In the little village of Bethany, where some chosen family gathered to grieve the death of Lazarus, because all they knew and all they could see pointed them to what looked like a loss in their family and the casual indifference of what they thought was the one person who could have headed it all off, kept it from happening. But now, just a person who looked like he didn't care enough to show up. I am the resurrection and the life. And Scripture indicates that until Jesus finally walked over to the tomb and said, "Lazarus, come out here," they didn't understand what Jesus meant by that. And I'm not sure I always do either. What does this mean for their time and for our time, their lives, our lives? What was significant here, according to West, is that the story repeatedly points us toward the importance of the act of believing itself. Believing, always a verb, never a noun, in the identity of Jesus and in His power to bring life out of death. There's an irony at work here. This story about life did bring about a death. Jesus' powerful teaching and action here brings Lazarus back to life. Life. Jesus' powerful teaching and action here brings us to an unmistakable foreshadowing of His resurrection. Life. But it also set in motion a lot of what got Jesus killed in the first place. Death. And right after this, in John 11, some of those friends from the church who had come to call on Mary and Martha believed. They saw what Jesus had done and they believed. But there were others. There were others of them, according to what starts up in verse 45 of your scripture, who just couldn't get on board. They didn't really say anything right then. They were the church members who couldn't wait to get back to the parking lot so they could talk among themselves. They went home, got on the phone, fired off some sneaky emails to the other Pharisees they knew. And that's a story for another day. If he'd hurried back and saved Lazarus' life when the cry for help first went out, I doubt we'd have heard this dramatic affirmation to believe or not to believe ourselves either. And I don't know if we'd have believed when we were there either, you or me. Not quite in this way. Because Martha, if she hadn't fussed at Jesus, she wouldn't have given him the opportunity to respond with these powerful, life-giving words either. I am the resurrection and the life. And as we draw closer to Him, and as we live a little more like the resurrected Jesus, we find that life. Life out of death. Turns out, he wasn't kidding. Jesus, in his last moments with the disciples before he was arrested, took them upstairs to a room where he could be with them by themselves. No crowds, no outer circle folks, just the inner circle. And he served a very simple meal to them, it seems. He had bread on the table and he had wine. He broke the bread and he explained to them, continuing this metaphor, he explained to them that he was now breaking that bread of life and going to offer it for them. He also said that the cup that was in front of them represented his blood, which was about to be poured out. And they took that meal, that very simple meal. And he reminded them then and later that each time they did that, they should do so in remembrance of him. Considering and reflecting on important notions like, I am the resurrection and the life. I hope you'll leave here pondering what that means for you. I hope you'll leave here meaning to explore not how short we all fall of living those words and always understanding them, but what happens when we do understand the words and what happens when we do live a little more like Jesus. When we do that, we make our church a little better. When we do that, we make our home a little better. When we do that, we make our community a little better. When we do that, we give others and ourselves hope. That all this stuff Jesus was talking about was real. We come to the table just now, as is our custom, on the first Sunday of each month. And the invitation is the same as it always is. It is for us to take up the cup and for us to have taken up the bread and to celebrate and to remember and to confess and to cleanse our hearts, that we also might experience this resurrection and this life. Jesus